We're rolling.
I'm over it. I'm over rolling.
I don't really know what to say today, and maybe that's a good thing.
The question that I keep asking is, what do you say when you don't know what to say? Is it a truer thing to rehearse what you're going to say and say it, or just express what spontaneously comes to you in the moment? Because most of my life has been a performance, which is to say, I had a spontaneous moment of inspiration where something came to me and I said it, and I said it over and over and over again, hoping that it was true, not knowing. Welcome to Hey Creator, I'm Jeff Coins, and this is the mixtape for the creative class, where we discover together what it is we're doing with our lives and with our art. And today we're talking about dreams and bulls and tattoos and why the thing that we think we want is never actually it, that there's always something beyond that. And what we find beyond the thing that we want is ourselves. And there is something magical and transcendent and extremely practical about using creativity, using the act of making things as a means to getting in touch with ourselves. And we might think of this as transcendence or enlightenment or spirituality, or simply just doing stuff with the time that we have here on earth. But there is something profound that can happen. There's an invitation in our own creative work to better understand ourselves, what we're capable of, and what all of this means. So, you know, don't expect this to go anywhere, because it is, after all, just a dream.
Okay, so I've turned to the random topic generator. And today's topic is... Da, 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 da. What do you think of tattoos? Do you have any?
Is that an actual tool?
Yeah.
You have a tattoo, don't you?
I do.
Just one?
I've got four different tattoos.
Like, they're all kind of around your buttocks, right?
Correct.
It's like a constellation of tattoos.
It is, yeah. They just kind of all point to the same place.
All pointing to the same place. Naturally, I want to get a tattoo, but I'm thinking about it too much. And the problem with that is, you don't like get a tattoo. Like, I don't think there are well planned tattoos. I mean, I think there are poorly planned tattoos, but I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but it's like you sort of have to commit to it and hope it works out for the best. It's a marriage of sorts, I suppose.
Yeah. And you also need to find the right artist.
Yeah.
Somebody who can really bring life to whatever your vision is. And of course, you know, tattoos are like frozen in time.
Right.
So they kind of, you know, it has to speak to something that's kind of more universal as opposed to like what you're feeling that day. Right.
Yeah. I mean, Chantel has a tattoo and, you know, she says it's just a reminder of who she was. You know, she got it when she was like 18, 19 years old or something, you know, who she was at that time.
Yeah.
That's why I'm just going to get a big one on my face, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like a rapper.
What are your tattoos?
I've got some from my youth.
From your youth? From your like 12?
Yeah. You know? When I was 12.
Those are cigarette burns. Those don't count.
Well, I was told that they were
tomato, tomato. He said he loved me.
No, I had been kind of in love with these Zen woodblock paintings from, it's a collection called the 10 Bulls. And it's a pretty it's a pretty famous collection of Zen art. You'd probably recognize it, but it's the fourth in the collection. I can show it to you, but cause it's kind of upside down. Hang on.
Oh, cool. That is cool.
And it's a parable on enlightenment. So in the fourth frame, in the fourth like koan or whatever, he's just discovered the bull. First, he's looking and he can't find the bull. And in the fourth story, he finds the bull. He grabs onto the tail, and then the question is, then what do you do with the bull once you have it by the tail? because really, what can you do?
I'm like, that sounds like Japanese art. Like, it's just like pictures of stuff. And they're like, no, it means things. I'm like, that's just a mountain. No, that's you. You are the mountain. No, it's a mountain. You know, it's like this is just a picture of a chihuahua. I don't know how to break it to you guys. You know, that's like one of these pictures looks like it's a blank picture. It's just like a, you know, coffee ring on your table. Kuan Shiyuan's 10 bulls. 1, in search of the bull. 2, discovery of the footprints. 3, perceiving the bull. 4, catching the bull. The poem that accompanies this section of the story is, I seize him with a terrific struggle. His great will and power are inexhaustible. He charges to the high plateau far above the cloud mists. Or in an impenetrable ravine he stands. Yeah, I mean, what you gonna do with that bull?
No idea.
5,
you gotta tame it.
Taming the bull. 6, riding the bull home. 7, the bull transcended. 8, both bull and self transcended. 9, reaching the source. 10, return to society. So he takes the bull home. He is serene. The bull can rest. The dawn has come. In blissful repose with my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. Whip, rope, person, and ox all merge into no thing. Heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors. Too many steps have been taken returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning, dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without. The river flows tranquilly on and the flowers are red. Barefoot and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden, and I am ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. Now before me, the dead trees become alive.
That's nice.
I like that. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that got me too.
Here are the footprints of the ancestors. That's a good line. You know, sometimes Eastern poetry is pretty dull, I think, you know, like they're too non-dual, that nothing's exciting. You know, you got to throw a little sex in there, a little agony, a little pain. little longing, you know, to have something interesting going on. And that's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
So you look for a bull, find some footprints. You see the bull, catch the bull, tame the bull, ride the bull. Bull disappears. And you disappear. And you return to the source and you come back to society. What does that bull mean to you?
Something profoundly strange about reality and that there is like this search, I think, early in life, at least in my own journey, for something, you know, something of meaning, something deeper, something more, I don't know, something beneath the surface of everything, you know, when you kind of, I think at a certain point when you kind of become disenfranchised with America or capitalism or just like the workings of the Western world, you know, you kind of hunt for like, what does all this shit mean? Like, isn't there something more important here that we're missing? You know, I think that's in part where, you know, some of that Zen and Taoist leaning comes from. It's kind of like, yeah, no, you're missing the point. Like, as soon as you think you know the answer, you know, you realize you're wrong. There is no answer. You know, it's like the sound of one hand clapping or something like that. You know, it's like, oh shit. It's been there the whole time.
The 10 bulls story starts with, in the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the ox. Following unnamed rivers lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. My strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the ox. And then, you know, he does find it. And then,
you know, at the end of the story, he loses it, kind of loses himself and realizes what it's all about. Dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on and the flowers are red. And then he rejoins society. Now before me, the dead trees become alive. That's what I pick up, you know. Everybody's got a bull, man. Everybody's got a thing that they don't have. And they swear if they had that, they'd be okay. Some people spend their whole lives searching for the bull. Some people get it and go, no, that's not it. I want something else. But I think the acquisition of any desired thing is the opportunity to drop deeper into yourself and realize I am searching for myself. I'm searching for me. I'm not searching for something outside of myself. And I think one way to interpret the story is he creates the bull. He imagines it, materializes it, because that's what you do when you want something badly enough. You know, you create it. And if you think the thing that you created is it, you're going to suffer. You know, it's not going to be good. Because the point of a creation is to point back to the creator, you know, to get into whatever moment you're in right now and go, you're it. Like this, you're the thing you've been searching for. Isn't it like a Sufi saying? When I searched for God, I only found myself. When I searched for myself, I only found God.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like the Buddhist idea of suffering. You know, it's just, it's self-made for the most part. You know, it's a desire for something outside of oneself that causes suffering.
Yeah. And I misunderstood that for a long time. I mean, I like things. I like wanting. I like going after things. So I kind of misunderstood the concept of desire, you know, but it's like, you're really clinging to that thing, you know. You're wanting things with an attachment to them, which is to say, when I get this, I'll be happy. What is that saying? Adulthood is basically an endless process of saying to yourself, once I get through this week, things will settle down until you die. And it's like that.
Right.
It's like, let me just get through this, you know. Let me stay up late to hit this deadline, which is my story, why I'm dragging this morning. And get through this, pick up the kids and do these other five things. And then I'll rest. Then I'll be okay. And the problem is either that never happens or it does and you still can't rest, right? Either way, you're kind of screwed. And I think the point of that truth is, look, man, you ain't happy now. You ain't going to be happy later. Because it's still you. How could you be happy with something else if you're not happy now? And I know people take issue with it. And it's like, oh, that's a really privileged thing to say. And it totally is. And, you know, what would you, you know, like, what about people living in abject poverty? Blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm not talking to those people. I'm talking to you. Listen to a fucking podcast, right? You're not those people. We can deal with those people separately. But, you know, you and I are inventing reasons to not be happy. And by the way, I've met some of those people, you know, in some of the worst slums in the world. And I met there even happy people and unhappy people. And it might be easier to be unhappy living in a garbage dump than, you know, living in a penthouse. But I don't know, dude. Like, I met happy people there too, and I've met plenty of unhappy rich people. I really don't think these circumstances have as much to do with our internal state as we believe they do. You know, that is what Hindus call the illusion, Maya, the world of form wherein which you play with the idea that if I do this, I'll be okay. So after my concert last night, I did what any sane man would do. I drank some Sauvignon Blanc and started watching Inception.
Oh, God. Yes. That's what I would do.
I know.
Your ears are probably still ringing.
When I searched for enlightenment, I only found Inception. When I searched for Inception, I only found enlightenment.
I only found Memento.
You know, that movie is really good. A friend pointed me back to it a while ago, and I had a rewatch. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Because there's so many layers to it. But he basically said, you know, this is it. This is life. Life is the dream. And there's some good lines in there. You know, he says, basically, in Inception, they've invented the technology to have a shared dream. You know, everybody kind of goes under taking this chemical and they all like plug into some sort of apparatus, and they don't explain how the science works, which is brilliant. But you have a shared dream, and you have a person who creates the dream, and then you have a person who you've got the architect, and then you've got the dreamer who fills the dream with their own projections. And if you try to change too much in the dream, the projections come after you. And that's true. And this is old. I mean, these are old ideas. The idea that life is a dream is a really old idea. It, you know, the oldest religions in the world teach this. You can even see it in the New Testament, where Jesus talks about the world and the kingdom of heaven. And these are different forces, but they seem to be occupying the same space. You know, the kingdom of heaven is here. It's coming. It is a spiritual reality, and potentially a political or social reality as well, where, you know, all the things that are wrong in the world are made right. You know, lots of different ways to think through that, obviously, and people fight wars over this shit. But, you know, the mystical way to look at it would be everything is already all right. And once we realize that, you know, we're okay. We're just here. You know, we don't need a bowl. We can just be, you know. I use no magic to extend my life. Now before me, the dead trees become alive. I think about this sometimes, you know, if you really kind of transcend the whole thing, why wouldn't you like become the most powerful person in the world, right? Like if it is a dream and you can do anything, you know, wake up from the dream and you become a lucid dreamer. Why wouldn't you just, you know, be Elon Musk or something? And I think because, you know, when you realize it's a dream, you're like, oh, I mean, who cares? I could have power. I could not have power. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make me happy. I could just sit here and watch a sunset. That's amazing.
Right.
And so it's an interesting thing when you think about a creative journey, because most of us are trying to attain something by creating something. We're trying to catch a bull. Once you catch the bull, you got to tame the bull. Once you tame the bull, you got to ride the bull, you know? And there's a labor in getting the thing that you want, which this story seems to illuminate. Mounting the ox, slowly I return home. The voice of my flute. I mean, this dude's riding a bull playing a flute, you know? Try to single task, bro. This dude is not zen at all. He's not being mindful at all. It's a great illustration, right? It's like, let me do lots of things so that in hopes that one of them will make me happy. And if you've never not been fully present for anything, you realize how much of any particular thing you're missing out on. Or maybe you don't, but I've started to become aware of that. I'm like, oh, this really doesn't work. I can multitask. It is possible. And I'm not really here for any of it. I'm sort of like sleepwalking. Elon Musk said in an interview one time that when he's with his kids, he checks his email, he's spending time with his kids. And the interviewer was like, you know, don't you worry that's distracting. And he says, well, you know, they're kids. They don't need my full attention all the time. And he goes, but if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be able to get my work done. And it's like, well, I mean, you don't know kids very well. I remember when my daughter was maybe two, I was, I don't know, being an idiot, doing something else while she was with me and looking at my screen or something and talking to her. And she's talking to me, trying to show me something amazing. She's always trying to show me something amazing. I think daughters have a particularly precious relationship with their fathers.
And she walked up to me. And she grabbed my face while I was looking at my screen, and she pulled my face and turned it towards me. Like, I mean, she just like instinctively knew that I was not looking at her or paying attention to her. Mm-hmm. And I mean, children understand this better than adults. Adults, you know, can think abstractly, but the most important thing for you to do with a baby is look at them, right? I mean, that's it activates their mirror neurons. It teaches them how to react to certain situations. It calms their nervous system down. It makes them feel secure. When you leave the room, they have no spatial awareness. They don't know. They have no object permanence. They don't know that you're still there. That's why you can play peekaboo with a baby and they laugh, cry, whatever. They get real emotional about it. And so, you know, riding a bull, playing a flute. The voice of my flute intones through the evening, measuring with hand beats the pulsating harmony. I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me. I mean, it's a really, what's cool about Zen is they don't tell you what it means, right? You've just got to sit with it, right? You get to sort of create your own meaning. But I mean, it sounds to be like a positive thing, you know? He's tamed the bull. He's riding home. He's like,
do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's a party. You know?
Yeah, he's like, people will join me. What an idiot. You know, he's like, look what I did. I'm totally this guy. I've caught some bulls, rid them home, you know, playing my flute. Or, you know, like, come on, people. Where's my parade? And then he reaches home. He's serene. The ox can rest too. The dawn has come. I have abandoned the whip and ropes. And then, you know, and then transcendence happens. I don't know exactly how that happens. I feel like they missed a couple of steps. Like, dude goes home, picture of him praying to a mountain, and then there's just nothing.
Yeah. Everything just
disappears. Yeah.
Into the void.
Hey, creator. This episode is brought to you by Aura. Aura is a digital safety service that monitors and protects your identity, finances, devices, and more from the bad guys. We all love the internet, right? We love it so much that we knowingly take risks every day while doing little to protect ourselves online. We do this because most security tools are complicated, expensive, or just plain confusing. So now, for a limited time, Aura is offering our listeners a 14-day trial plus a check on your data to see if you have already been part of a data breach, all for free when you visit goinswriter.com/Aura. That's goinswriter.com/AURA. Go there and sign up for a 14-day free trial to see if you've already been part of a data breach. It's totally free. That's goinswriter.com/Aura. Certain terms apply. See site for details. Aura is the new standard in digital safety. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I mean, I think that's a wonderful picture of getting the stuff that you want and using that desire to get you beyond the thing desired. I can relate to wanting a thing, getting it, and then being disappointed by the thing. And then going, oh, the thing's not the point, you know? I'm the point. I'm here. And then, you know, two minutes go by and I go, now I want a new thing. Hmm. And the Enzo, as I understood it, you know, you said a brief moment of enlightenment. It's like, oh, I get those. I get little like glimpses of unity and I go, oh, all is well. Everything's great. I have them on this show sometimes. And then I drop back into the world of bulls and suffering and playing flutes on animals. You know? The question that I keep asking is, what do you say when you don't know what to say? Is it a truer thing to rehearse what you're going to say and say it, or just express what spontaneously comes to you in the moment? Because most of my life has been a performance, which is to say, I had a spontaneous moment of inspiration where something came to me and I said it, and I said it over and over and over again, hoping that it was true, not knowing. But it sounded good, so I kept saying it, whatever the thing might be. And I've recently become aware of some of the things that I've said, stories that I've told in this podcast, like playing a concert in Taiwan and having a young woman, a teenage girl, pass out, you know, faint. And I realized, I don't know if that happened. I know I've told that story 100 times, and I've told it that way for a long time. But I don't know. Maybe she just threw her head back.
maybe nothing happened. And I just filled the story with a detail. Because, I mean, that's how stories happen, you know? For me, I'm standing on stage or sharing with an audience and I'm not lying, just like something comes to mind that's, you know, spontaneously didn't come to mind before. And I go, this happened. And everybody reacts. And then it sort of solidifies the memory and it feels good. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah. It happened like that. Reminds me of the movie Big Fish, where Ewan McGregor's the dad, and then he's got he gets older, right? And there's these flashbacks between kind of the youthful guy, which is Ewan McGregor, and then the older guy. And the dad's on his deathbed, and he's told his son all these tall tales, all these, you know, fish stories, right? And the son is jaded because he thinks his father's lied to him because they're crazy stories, you know? And my dad told me stories like that, you know, meeting Santa Claus. Like I didn't stop believing in Santa Claus until I was 11 years old because my dad met him, you know, and he had this very convincing story. And I was devastated. I mean, I cried and screamed at my parents when I found out there was no Santa. And my dad was like, well, you know, he's real in your heart. And I'm like, that's bullshit, Dad. You know, you're a liar. What else have you lied to me about? But that is the process of growing up, is realizing some things are true because they happened. Other things are true because they should have happened. You know, and as non-objective as that sounds, welcome to the world. The world is not objective. The world is subjective. Meaning you are a part of the world. You are not, the world is not something separate from you. You are a part of the universe. You are a part of humanity. You, as Alan Watts says, you don't come into this world, you come out of it. You're not something separate from this world. Your molecules didn't materialize out of nothing. They came from your mom and your dad, which came from their mom and their dads, and, you know, which eventually came from something else. This all came from something else and somehow magically turned into something that understood itself as unique and separate and individual. And so, yeah, I mean, we understand ourselves as individuals and therefore we want to create something unique to express that individuality. And that's really beautiful and a little misguided, I think, because to think of the world objectively is to go, the world is an object. Experience, reality is an object. It is something that I can apprehend as separate. I can grab it. I can grasp it. Pick up an object. You can feel it. You can touch it. You can experience. You can get the bowl. But, you know, in a sense, you are the bowl, or you and the bowl, rather, are part of the same cosmic circle that's being drawn. You are a part of the experience of existence. Therefore, you are subject, not object. The whole thing is subjective. The whole thing is itself experiencing itself. That's not necessarily spiritual. I mean, it's pretty practical, right? Like, there's this thing called the universe. You're a piece of it. And you are a piece of it that has awareness of itself and your surroundings, sort of, right? ever tell a story one way and somebody else who was there told it another way? What happened? Exactly. What happened was you both had experiences of the experience and told different stories about it. That's what happened. This idea that there's some sort of object that you can attain that's going to make it all make sense is illusion, is a fantasy. And what I think is interesting about the movie Inception is my favorite part of that movie is when Marion Cotillard is saying to Leo DiCaprio in one of his dreams, you don't believe in one reality anymore. And she said, and she kind of taunts him, you know, are you still running from faceless corporations? Still trying to get back to your children. I mean, he's playing a game, right? Like it's the plot of a movie. You've got to have a story that works within our realm of understanding. But it's like, what do you need in order to have a story? You've got to have a character who wants something. He has to experience conflict, resistance to get that something. And there has to often be some sort of antagonistic force or enemy that's preventing him from doing that thing. And the thing that he wants actually has to be difficult. And there's definitely an underlying theme, which is that the world that he's living in, that he thinks he's living in, what he calls reality, might be another dream. I mean, that's really the mindfuck of the movie, is if you could just keep going deeper into dreamland, then what does it mean to be real anyway? And there's a scene where these guys are in Mombasa, Africa, Kenya, and they're all sleeping, you know, they sleep four hours a day. They come in and sleep with this special compound, and it's the only way they can dream anymore. And there's this old guy there who says, you know, somebody says, they come here to sleep all day? He goes, no, they come here to wake up, because this is reality for them. And who are you to say otherwise? But what's interesting is you get to the end of the movie and Dom, the Leo DiCaprio character, has his little totem, his little top or whatever, you know, his little spinny thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he spins the top and he walks away. And the movie ends not, you don't know if it falls over or not. And if it falls over, he's in the real world. If it doesn't fall over, he's still dreaming. And he goes and plays with his kids. In theory. And Chris Nolan was interviewed and they were like, you know, is this the real world or not? Does the top fall over? Because that ending kind of confused people. And he basically said, yeah, it falls over. This is the real world. Which is like a really shitty thing for a director to say for a writer. It's like, but you didn't write that. That's not what's in the movie. What's in the movie is what's in the movie. Right? So the point is, you decide what's real, what matters, what doesn't. When you're dreaming, it feels real. When you wake up, that feels real. Who's to say one is more real than the other? In La Vida es Sueño, Life is a Dream, Calderón de la Barca tells a story about Segismundo, who is a Polish prince. He's imprisoned at an early age because his father gets a prophecy that the son is going to overthrow him. Eventually that prophecy comes true. The king feels bad, so he lets his son out when he's like a 18-year-old man. The kid gets pissed because he finds out that his dad has kept him in a tower his whole life. Tries to kill a bunch of people. They drug him. They put him back to sleep. They put him back in the tower and they convince him it was all a dream. It wasn't, according to the story. Then the only guy that he interacts with is just like a sort of mentor, basically tells him, we never know if we're dreaming or not, so we should always be honorable. We should always act honorably. So if you're in your dream, act as if you're not in your dream, right? Like if you're out of your dream, you think you're not dreaming, act good anyway, because you never know. And you're always living within the reality that you're in. And in that reality, there are consequences. And so, like, just don't go around hurting people because you think you're going to get away with it, because there are consequences for that, even in a dream world. And of course, I mean, I've had dreams where I feel like, you know, there are no rules. I kind of do whatever I want. But I like that idea, like whether you're dreaming or you're awake, always act with honor. Always act in a way that is worthy of your own respect, that is worthy of your own values. So act one is Segismundo escape. Well, he gets let out. He tries to kill a bunch of people, including his mentor, including his caretaker, who's has been visiting him all these years. He's the only person he's had interaction with, hasn't even seen his father, the king. They throw him back in the prison. They throw him back in the tower. And in act two, they convince him it was all a dream. He's totally like, what? It seemed really real. He's like, well, dreams are like that, you know? And this is where the life is a dream concept comes from. And he has this monologue, I think, at the end of act two, where he says that, you know, life is a dream. And there's some, it's one of my favorite passages in literature. I read it in college. I tried to read it in college. I was just fascinated with it for some reason. As a Spanish major, I was reading it in the original Spanish. And like, you know, any old piece of literature, I mean, Pedro Calderón de la Barca is kind of, he's a little bit later than Shakespeare, but he was basically a contemporary of Shakespeare, you know, and kind of Spain's version of Shakespeare, like a pretty big playwright who wrote these incredible stories that were famous throughout Spain and much of the Spanish speaking world and probably other parts of the Western world at the time. But yeah, I mean, it's a good little poem. He says, "We live while we see the sun, where life and dreams are as one. And living has taught me this. Man dreams the life that is his until his living is done."
Hmm.
"The king dreams he is a king, and he lives in the deceit of a king, commanding and governing, and all the praise he receives is written in wind and leaves, a little dust on the way, when death ends all with a breath. Where then is the gain of a throne that shall perish and not be known in the other dream that is death?" He goes on and on. You know, the rich man dreams that he's rich. The poor man dreams of his need. He dreams of prospering. You know, he dreams of getting back at his enemies, all this stuff. And he goes, "And in all the world I see, man dreams whatever he be. And his own dream no man knows. And I too dream, and behold, I dream I am bound with chains. And I dream that these present pains were fortunate ways of old." And then he goes, "What is life? A tale that is told. What is life? A frenzy extreme." The word in Spanish is un frenesi, which is just a fun word to say. Frenesi. It's a frenzy. It's kind of this like erratic thing. It's a hard word to translate. It's a frenzy, you know? "What is life? A tale that is told. What is life? A frenzy extreme. A shadow of things that seem. And the greatest good is but small. That all life is a dream to all. And that dreams themselves are a dream." And so he kind of, you know, he ends act two with this existential quandary, which is like, everything's a dream. Dreams are dreams. You know, you're always living in your own reality. You're always living in your own little story. And then in act three, the people of Poland find out that the prince is imprisoned, and they stage a revolt, and they let out the main character's name is Segismundo. And Segismundo escapes, and he kind of leads this rebellion, and they storm the castle, and they want to kill the king, who is his father, and he remembers the advice of his mentor, who says, "Remember that this might be a dream, and you should always act honorably." So he doesn't kill his mentor, and he doesn't kill his dad. He spares his life, even though what has happened to him has been unjust. You know, he was imprisoned as a baby all the way through his young adulthood for fear that he might overthrow his father. And obviously that's kind of a chicken and egg thing, because it actually ends up happening. That's kind of a, like, I think that's a very Shakespearean sort of plot twist. The thing you're trying to avoid is the thing that you end up making happen. And so he gets to the end of the play, and it's a, you know, relatively happy ending where he realizes he kind of makes all things right. Because he realizes, I could be dreaming, I could be not. I need to act as honorably as possible. But he really does, like, the whole rebellion, he thinks, this is a dream, this is not happening. And he just kind of goes along with it, the whole third act of the play. And from the perspective of the playwright, it is all happening in quote-unquote reality. And so I think that one of the things that can happen, and really what I have been trying to do with this little podcast, is it's not just, you know, talk about nonsense, but demonstrate that the process of making things, the work of being a creator, is inherently what we might call a spiritual process, which is not particularly religious, doesn't require any set of practices. The practice is creation, to make things, creativity. But in making those things, you commune with a part of yourself that you may not be completely familiar with, a part that feels transcendent. And the act of making things gets you into a more conscious state of realizing, I'm the dreamer. I'm the one making all this stuff happen, in the sense that how I perceive the world is how it is to me, right? How I frame the story is the story, right? Like, I am, these people are chasing me, and so-and-so is out to get me, and if I don't do this, I can't win. Like, it's all a dream. It's all like a game. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But a dream that feels out of control, that you don't know you can control, it can be terrifying. It can be exciting. It can also be terrifying. But if you do what Segismundo did, or even what Dom Cobb in Inception does, which is you get to a point where you go, I don't care if I'm dreaming. That's the brilliance of the end of Inception, is he goes, I'm tired of wondering which reality I'm in. I'm just going to, because I can't control whether I wake up or what I wake up into. So I'm just going to control who I am in this story right now. And I'm going to go play with my kids. I'm not going to sit here and existentially pontificate on the potential nature of reality, the potential objective nature of reality. Because reality is not objective. It is not an object that I can grasp outside of myself. I am it. I am part of reality. Therefore, reality is inherently subjective. And your reality is going to be different from mine because of who you are. And I think what's interesting is when our stories sort of intersect and we go, oh, I've experienced this and you've experienced that, we begin to experience something that we might call objective, where your subjective experience and my subjective experience have certain alignments, you know, and we go, oh, well, isn't that interesting? But I love an Inception where he basically says, you know, if you start disrupting the dream, people come after you. These are your projections. These are the versions of yourself that are not okay with change. And I remember feeling this when I was going through the early stages of divorce, when I had filed, hadn't moved out yet. We'd started telling our friends and, you know, living in a very Christian part of the country, having a lot of friends who are evangelicals, a lot of church going folks. That is our reality here, you know, and divorce is not a quote unquote good thing culturally here. But what's interesting is I imagine lots of people were going to come after me, and it didn't really happen. I mean, I was scared and I kind of like ran away from relationships, but there was like one or two people who maybe said something rude to me, something inappropriate or just like not empathetic. You know, you need to fix this. You need to do whatever you need to do to not go through with this, which was, you know, their projection. There was a part of me who for many, many years said, I will never do this, you know, this is wrong, you know, and judged other people for going through things that I actually didn't understand. And so those parts of me were coming after me, and they just happened to be wearing other people's faces. And you see that in Inception, where it's happening in every layer of the dream. He's got people running after him because he's broken some rule or done some bad thing, and they're trying to kill him. And he's got to escape from them. He's got to get the thing that he needs to get so that he can get back home and, you know, all will be well. I mean, all those things happen. And you're kind of wondering, was this just another dream? And maybe. And it seems that one way to transcend the dream is to get all the things that you wanted to get the bull, to ride the bull, to play the flute. and to use that as a way to get into the space of nothingness, the void, where you go, oh, all of this experience is just stuff happening in the field of awareness, in the space that I'm able to see it, experience it, know it. I'm the one making this happen. And I don't mean that in like a Bruce Almighty kind of way. I don't. I think things are happening, but they are happening. The only way that we know they're happening is because we're aware of them. And so in that sense, the things that are happening to you and around you are happening in your awareness, you know, or in awareness, period. And you are participating in that space. And certainly, you know, a belief, an idea is that that's all there is, you know, is awareness and all of it's happening within that. That is the fundamental construct of the universe. I don't know. I have no way of proving that other than it's the only thing we all seem to have in common, which is that we are aware of our existence and that there is such a thing as existence. And that awareness, or rather the perception of the things happening, is pretty damn imprecise, it seems. Like, you know, read an eyewitness account. You know, read 20 eyewitness accounts of a thing happening. Did something actually happen? Seems that way. What was it? Hell if we know. You know, but we could record it. Okay, and then you've got people watching a recording. It's still coming through a lens. You know, it's there's still perception. Why does all this matter? Well, maybe it doesn't. You know, but I do think that creative transcendence is the process of going, I want the bull. I want the bull. I've got to do these things, escape these challenges, overcome them, and get the thing that I want, and then I'll be happy. And you get the thing that you want, and you go, who is it that's going to be happy here? And you get into that space of I, you know, who is the one asking the question? That's what Zen koans, I think, are trying to do. They're trying to get you into a space of being. Like, who am I when all of the stories, all of the striving, all of the awards and accolades drop? Who am I without all of these stories? And there is no answer. That's the point. The point is there is something in you that is you, that is aware. And from that space of seeming nothingness, you stare into the void is staring right back at you, because there is always consciousness, there is always awareness. As long as there is someone to ask the question, there is something other than nothing. But out of that nothing comes everything. You know, when you contemplate nothingness, when you have nothing to say, something is said, right? What is it? Out of the silence, stillness speaks, right? Like there is a hum of existence even when you get everything to quiet down, you know? Don't say anything. Don't do anything. And you get really, really quiet and you go, gosh, I can actually feel my body sort of vibrating a little bit. I can feel my heart beating. I can feel blood being pumped through my veins. I can feel my lungs breathing without my even trying to make them happen. Something is always happening. Sounds are always being made. And I'm here to observe it in some way. That's tremendous. And I think you get to that space. And I think wanting things is a wonderful way to get to that space. It works for me, you know, better than meditation. Go do something, but be really aware when you do that something. And use the striving, the accomplishment, the doing to get to who you really are. You know, the 10 Bulls story says, dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on and the flowers are red. And what does he say before that? Too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. He's like, oh, shit. I didn't need to do anything. And in fact, my doing, all that accomplishing, got in the way of reality, which is, it's all good, man. You know, it's all good. It's fine. Look at the trees, you know, look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field. It's pretty astounding. And from that space of nothingness, like tranquility, nothingness is not bad. It's beautiful because it's the place from which all things come. That's where you get creative. That's where good stuff comes from, is out of nothingness, not out of a sense of I've got to prove something to the world. But go do that, right? Like if you got to go do that, go do it. That's wonderful. Good for you. Well done. World's best cup of coffee. You did it. You made it. At some point, you've got to realize I'm living in my own self-constructed dream, which is to say that I'm living in an existence where I am the subject experiencing all of these things in this thing called my life. And there may be other subjects experiencing the same thing. It may just be me. I don't know. I have no way of knowing that. You are a character in my story, but you know, like I'm more important in my story than you are. Sorry. You only make it into a handful of scenes in the movie. I'm in every one. I am legitimately more important than you in my story. And I suppose that that has a tendency to create, you know, narcissism or even cruelty in a person. But that's not been my experience. You know, my experience is the more sensitive you get to life, the more you realize, well, if you are a being in my story, in my dream, I created you. At least the version of you that I experienced, that, you know, I've created you through my own perception and awareness. You know, so you're a part of me. I wouldn't want to destroy you. Like, we're all a part of the same thing. And I wouldn't want to be unkind to you either. I would care about you and be interested in your experience of the dream. You know, do you like the dream that I've built for you? How's it going? And of course, it may be that we're all having these sort of dreams, and they're all kind of connecting and colliding in this grander thing called existence. And maybe there's something out there dreaming all of this as well. But what I do think is interesting is everything happening in a dream belongs to the dreamer. So everything happening in my life belongs to me. It's part of me. Again, at a very practical level, in the sense that I'm experiencing it through my own lens of perception, and that lens affects how I interpret the things happening to me. And that's a pretty important thing. You know, I shine that lens up. It really affects my experience of things. That's why somebody can have something really bad happen to them and they're fine with it. They actually are just fine with it because they have a different lens, and something, the same thing can happen to somebody else and they have a completely different reaction because it's a different lens. Not a different thing happening necessarily, but it's happening to someone in a different way because they are perceiving it differently. So, I think life gets interesting when you go, this may all be a dream. I don't know, but I'm going to choose to act as honorably as I possibly can, because even in a dream, there are consequences for one's actions. And I'm going to create the best stuff I can create. I'm going to say the best things I can say. I'm going to be kind and compassionate to as many people as possible. You know, Buddhism itself is a non-dual path. There's only one thing. You are a part of that one thing, and it evokes deep compassion for all beings. You know, all beings are part of life. Trees, rocks, ants, you know, all things are a form of life in some sense. And so you go, oh, we're all part of the same stuff. I'm not better or, you know, more special. I'm just different. And so I'm going to be realizing that oneness. I'm going to be compassionate to all things. And I think if you make enough things, you start to feel some of that. You start to go, oh, you can create almost anything in your life. You can create anything in your life if you really want to, if you really focus. And I know there's a narrative in all of us, or almost all of us, that goes, well, not anything. It's like, okay, I mean, fine. But I keep finding my edge of what I think is possible and stepping over it and not falling off a cliff. I like that the story is called, I'm calling it a story, 10 bulls. Not one bull, but 10 bulls. And there's the bull that he's searching for. There's the bull that's almost there, the discovery of the footprints. There's the part where he just sees the tail, the back end of the bull, perceiving the bull. There's the bull that he catches. There's the bull that is tamed. There's the bull that he rides. Then there's the bull that disappears. Then there's the bull and self that have disappeared. Then there's the moment of enlightenment where he reaches the source. And then there's a return to society. Now, what's interesting is in these scenes, if you look at the pictures, there are only 1, 2, 3, 4 bulls. But there's 10 bulls, right? Even no bull is a bull. No bull. No bull, man. And it starts with the idea of a bull. I need to find a bull. This may all be a dream. He may have created all of this, right? And, you know, so what is your bull? What is the thing that you're trying to get? And if you pay close enough attention, you may realize that before there was a bull, like an actual physical bull, before there was a thing that you knew that you wanted, there was a bull, right? There was the sense that something was missing. And what I love about the story is you start and end in the same place, in a very hero's journey kind of way. But when you come back to society, you're different. You're changed. Joseph Campbell calls this master of two worlds, of the internal and external world. You've transcended something in yourself. And the spiritual journey is always an inward journey, right? All of these things are happening externally to take you on an inner path towards wholeness, towards completeness, where you realize I have everything in myself to be whatever it is that I'm supposed to be. And I'm already it. I just don't know it. And so these journeys, these processes of searching for things and getting them and getting disillusioned by them and growing through that disillusionment and re-entering society, you go, oh, it's never about the bull. It was about me. The bull was in me. But it's just really cool to think, you know, there's 10 different bulls. Perhaps the most significant thing you could ever want is actually the idea that you don't have it. That's where desire comes from, is I'm already coming to the game with a feeling like I'm missing something. And I like art because I think it's a way to get you into this space of going, oh, that's what life is about. Life is about making stuff and making something of yourself and realizing that ain't it. Like, that's cool, but that's not it. If I get attached to my work, I suffer. But if I use my work as an opportunity to transcend the activity and transcend all the stories about myself that I'm trying to tell, there's bliss there. And that artwork itself, you know, in the same way that you've got a tattoo on your arm, that means something to you. Like, it can be a message to somebody else. It can be a means for someone else to get to where they want to go. But that's hard and risky because some people might not get it. But who's to say your it and my it are the same it, you know? And so I can't do this in hopes of you getting my it. I can only do it in hopes of me getting it in front of you. And then maybe that is an invitation to your own process of figuring out what is my bull and what is beyond the bull, what is beyond the space of wanting things and getting them and losing them, what underlies all of that. And, you know, that's why we make things and that's why we consume things that are made, or at least that is a way to do those things. And I get real nervous, you know, talking about this stuff because it is useful to me, and I don't know if it's useful to other people. And that's okay. I think that's as it should be. I certainly have done the thing where I'm trying to be useful to people to the point that, you know, I'm riding the bull, playing the flute, going, everybody see me, everybody see me being useful. Isn't this great? You know? And then one person says that I didn't like that. That's not useful to me. And I'm like, fuck, you know? Suddenly the bull's gone. I'm just sitting here playing with my flute by myself. Thank you for tuning in to this issue of Hey Creator. I'm Jeff Goins. This show is produced by yours truly in conjunction with the very handsome Kelton Reed and the inimitable New Media Dojo. Our theme music is One Night in Las Vegas by Arthur Bassov, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. For extra goodies, all kinds of bonuses, you can go to heycreator.com. That's right, we have the .com domain these days. Sign up for the free newsletter. A new issue drops every single Tuesday. You get links to past episodes, other things that are happening in the Hey Creator universe, and a whole lot more. And don't forget to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a review at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in. We'll see you next time. Don't forget to keep it groovy. And the end of the play is, here is this hero becoming king. And they go, hail, 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 you know, you made it. You got the bull. And then those words turn into, wake up, wake up, wake up.
Oh, shit.
So, you know, it's all And it's fine. It's all a dream. Try not to take it too seriously and try not to be too stupid, you know? Like,